This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission held on August 23rd, 2012. Should you have questions after listening to the recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
Good morning. The open session for Thursday, August 23rd, 2012 will come to order. The first item on the agenda is the approval of the minutes for August 2nd, 2012. Madam Vice Chair, do you have a motion?
Yes, Madam Chair. I move that we approve the minutes for the meeting of August 2nd, 2012, as set forth in agenda document number 12-60.
Thank you. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The ayes have it. The motion passes. Madam Vice Chair, we have a few late submitted documents.
Just a couple. I move that we waive the rules on the timely submission of agenda documents so that we may consider agenda document number 12-63, 12-63A, 12-61, 12-61A, and 12-62.
Thank you. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The ayes have it. The motion passes. Thank you very much. The next matter on the agenda is Draft Advisory Opinion 2012-27, National Defense Committee. We're joined this morning by Mr. Benjamin Barr and Mr. Alan Dickerson. Thank you very much for joining us. We have a presentation this morning by the Office of General Counsel, Ms. Jessica Selenkoff.
Thank you, Chair Hunter. Good morning, Commissioners. Agenda documents 12-63 and 12-63A contain two drafts that respond to an advisory opinion request by National Defense Committee. National Defense Committee is a 501c4 corporation, and it asks whether seven communications it intends to distribute would be express advocacy, whether four donation requests it intends to make would be solicitations, and whether it would be a political committee. Draft A concludes that none of the communications are express advocacy or solicitations, and that National Defense Committee is not a political committee. Draft B concludes that four of the seven advertisements are express advocacy, two of the four donation requests are solicitations, and that National Defense Committee has not provided sufficient information to determine political committee status. The Commission received one comment on the request and no comments on the drafts. I'm available to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much. As mentioned, we have two drafts this morning. Are there any questions for counsel? Commissioner McGann.
Thank you. Let me, since counsel's here, let me ask a couple questions about the actual content of some of these ads. So I'm looking at draft B. Page 8. And the analysis begins line 8. Line 9, for example, says the advertisement identifies a candidate, (President Obama). But I don't see where the ad actually identifies him as a candidate. That's question one. And then where it says on line 13, where it says, and telling viewers to, quote, take a stand with us, unquote, by helping military persons, quote, vote out those who won't keep their promises, unquote, after accusing the president of putting, quote, promised military benefits, quote, unquote, at risk, quote, the advertisement can only be interpreted as containing advocacy for his defeat. I read that sentence, and then I read the ad, and it seems to me that analysis rewrites the ad. And since you're here and since it's your ad, I want to ask you, is lines 13 and as follows, that's not what the ad actually says, does it? And I want to make sure we have the facts right, because I don't think we can rewrite the ad to make the reg reach the ad. But I want to, I'm really getting at the facts here as an initial matter as to what the ad actually says. And I think the ad is summarized above there, I think, is correct, but it doesn't seem to say the same thing.
It seems an odd patchwork of the select portions of the advertisement filled in with additional inferences and context is written here. So if you look to the actual text of military voting hindered, we note that the emphasis here is about a discussion of veterans' benefits, criticism of the Justice Department, criticism of congressional liberals not standing up for military voting rights, and it asks whether they should be able to freely vote in the fall in the manner that they would like to, and take a stand with the organization and make sure that military voting is taken seriously. Military voting, that means with respect to military abroad and locally being able to cast their ballot in a manner they see fit. Issue advocacy. As to whether a candidate is named, it does not use the title president. It does not refer in that sense to his electoral competition. So, no, I don't see that being triggered here.
I mean, it certainly identifies President Obama, who is also a candidate, but the ad itself doesn't identify him as a candidate, as the draft suggests.
No, it does not.
Okay. It seems to me that looking at the ad and how it's been rewritten, there's an assumption there that anyone who answers the question of shouldn't those who dodge bullets for our freedom be free to vote their conscience and vote out those who won't keep their promises, the assumption is anyone that answers that question in the affirmative somehow then is always going to vote against President Obama, as if someone could not support President Obama at the polling place and also think that military votes ought to count or have voting rights or taken seriously or whatever the message is you choose to convey, which is you're right.
This is an important...
So nothing in the ad, though, says that.
Nothing in the ad says that.
Okay.
And indeed, the plain text of the communication is simply focusing on the importance of military voting. How those individuals vote, of course, is up to their preferences, but protecting that ability. And that's what the clear call to action at the end is, to take a stand with the organization and to protect military voting, not to vote for or against the clearly identified candidate.
In the previous ad, which draft B identifies as D, military voting matters. The draft claims that the phrase be heard this fall, according to the draft, it says the ad urges viewers to be heard this fall through their voices and votes, and that constitutes an electoral portion. But again, the ad doesn't really say that, I don't think. I mean, it certainly says be heard this fall. But it also says, shouldn't military voices and votes matter? Shouldn't yours be heard this fall? It assumes that yours and heard this fall only refers to votes. It couldn't be just that's talking about voices or votes of other citizens generally. It seems to make, again, an assumption that being heard this fall is somehow tied to an individual viewing the ad voting a certain way on Election Day. Again, that's not what the ad says, right?
No, the ad speaks to overseas military ballots and the ability of military servicemen and women serving abroad being able to have their vote count. And it's a call to that issue. Be heard this fall, cases like Christian Coalition, for example, use the term this November, simply referencing a particular time point doesn't transform the discussion of an issue into express advocacy.
The analysis continues. Reasonable minds could not differ that the advertisement exhorts the viewer to be heard by voting against Representative Pelosi. I guess the use of quotes is proper because it does say be heard, but the ad doesn't say be heard by voting against Representative Pelosi. That's an inference taken by what they claim to be the reasonable mind, the reasonable viewer, I suppose.
So be heard this fall. This might be a call to veterans to organize around express delivery of military ballots. It may be, alternatively, a call to support candidates who favor that express delivery. It may be a discussion for individuals to come and be organized and to speak out about this issue during the fall.
Or it may reflect simply the fact that this is going out in late summer.
And I guess there could be a viewer who does take this ad to say, well, this must mean I should vote against Nancy Pelosi. Let's assume there's that viewer. That's not the test, I don't think. I mean, even if someone could, I mean, that seems to be an effect test, which the commission's been told repeatedly cannot be used.
That's correct. Buckley and precedent following Buckley all indicate that the subjective reaction, the subjective intent, the audience reaction to speech cannot be a basis for regulation. And that's consistent with other areas of the First Amendment that introduces the heckler's veto issue. So long as one individual can look at speech and file a complaint and bog down an organization in an investigation, it raises serious issues. So this has been raised in the area of protest marches, parades, and other areas implicating First Amendment freedoms. It holds equally true here.
Go to the first ad, A, page 4, line 17, let's make history. Analysis begins by saying that it criticizes a clearly identified federal candidate. As quote, one of the least effective members of Congress. Right there, I think that's actually criticizing a member of Congress, not a candidate. But, you know, maybe words mean different things to different people. And urges viewers to, quote, make history by changing that this fall. And there's quotes, but again, that's not what the ad says. It's paraphrasing and sort of rearranging your speech to make it fit within come within the reach of a reg. That's not what the ad says.
No, again, there's patchwork.
I'm not talking about what your intent is. I'm talking about the actual four corners of the ad. That's not what it says.
Correct.
And then we have the old unmistakable and unambiguous electoral portion. You know, as such, the communication contains an unmistakable and unambiguous electoral portion that suggests of only one meaning. And reasonable minds could not differ regarding the meaning of the action of the advertisement encourages that the action encourages defeating the congresswoman this fall. So is that this fall is the electoral portion? Because that's not inherently electoral without other facts that are not in the actual ad. I'm just not sure how this connects, because the other thing that's missing in the analysis is that the paraphrase statements all relate to H.R. 3638. And that, of course, the analysis goes on to say the learn about H.R. 3638 doesn't alter this conclusion, and it tries to split the ad into two parts by saying this fall let's make history by changing that is somehow distinct from learning about the legislation, but that requires sort of they're reading into what that means. That can mean the bill. If you learn about the bill and you inform your representative that the bill is bad, maybe she will no longer be the most effective member of Congress. Maybe
Correct.
She'll change her view on legislation.
Correct. And you know, if you read it within its four corners, it's rather clear that this is about funding for frontline troops. It's about H.R. 3638. And to get to the point where an analysis says that we have express advocacy, we must make an inference that we know somehow through divination or expert skill what the meaning of that is. And so we have a communication that is discussing an issue that's important to a veterans organization. It includes a call to action at the end about learning about the bill in question, H.R. 3638. It discusses what the importance of that bill is, and it comments about the character of the candidate in question. Yet somehow we've tripped express advocacy under 100.2.
Which express advocacy doesn't seem to require express advocacy. It seems like this analysis is taking inferential advocacy at best and turning it into express advocacy.
When advertisements are rewritten, then
they can mean whatever the government then wants them to mean. Let me go to the major purpose part of the both analyses. One draft concludes that your client's not a political committee. The other draft, I think, concludes that there's insufficient facts. Could you educate me a little on how you take this going forward as someone who wants to participate in the political discourse of the day?
It seems to indicate that if you're asking for advice about where the line is between a regulated entity that has to undergo substantial disclosure requirements and essentially forego its associational privacy, you must give up all of those rights and provide detailed information about funding and spending to the FEC to complete a request that would exempt you from that disclosure. What we asked the FEC was that if you would simply take our statement that any additional activities were factually dissimilar, that is, they were outside of the reach of FECA, and provide us an analysis there so we know where the tripwires and regulatory boundaries were, that would be helpful. And every advisory opinion that's issued indicates that if the statements provided by counsel and by the parties are not true or they change or the like, then of course the holding of the AO doesn't protect them. So if the organization in question, if somehow that representation didn't hold up, later, the FEC would, of course, be free to investigate that. But we didn't feel, and clients were not inclined, to provide detailed private information to the FEC about its funding, about its budgets, about its donors, about past expenditures, just so that you could know where the line was.
So here's what I don't know. Because I think that the FEC has really made a hash of this entire area of the law. You have two drafts. If one passes, you have a statement by the commission that says you're not a political committee. If the other passes, you have a statement that says there aren't enough facts to determine whether you're not a political committee. But the converse of that is it doesn't say you are a political committee. So if let's assume, hypothetically, may not be hypothetical, but let's assume everything goes 3-3. So three support one draft and three support the other draft. So you have three commissioners saying you're not a political committee and the other three saying we don't have enough facts, but we're not going to say you are yet. So as of today, you're not a political committee because there's not four votes to say you are. So if you're not a political committee and you run an ad, let's take any of the ads that Draft B suggests are express advocacy, not because there's actually express words of advocacy of the sort in the Buckley decision or the facts of MCFL, but instead this more McConnell WRTL version. I've made this point repeatedly, but this is a different client and a different day, so I have to make it again. I have no idea what you're supposed to do, and I don't have any idea what you're supposed to do because if you're a political committee, you don't have to file electioneering communication reports. If you're not a political committee, then you may have to if these ads are run within a certain time period of elections. And we know because Citizens United tells us this, that Hillary the movie is the functional equivalent of express advocacy, therefore under the post-WRTL rule the commission promulgated, it would have been a banned electioneering communication, but it's still an electioneering communication. It's not an independent expenditure. So a lot of these ads, for, let's say for the sake of argument, look a lot like Hillary the movie. Just for fun, let's say it comes within that sort of no other way to read it, whatever that means, sort of test, which is a constitutional test. Whether something's constitutional or not really isn't the issue. As a practical matter, there's a statute where you have to file an independent expenditure report or you have to file an electioneering communication report if you're not a political committee. But if you're a political committee, then you don't. But we're not sure if you're a political committee, apparently. So if you run this ad, the commission has created this catch-22 situation where you really have no idea which report to file because they're two distinct reports. It's not the same reporting regime. And the conflating of WRTL with Buckley just doesn't do anyone any sort of service. It certainly helps. It helps when if one goes to court to defend the constitutionality of the reg in the abstract, it certainly helps do that because all one needs to say is 100.22b and WRTL are essentially the same thing, and that makes it constitutional. It's not the issue before us today. The issue is the practical issue of what reports you have to file. And if we can't tell you whether or not you're a political committee, there's no way you're going to know whether you have to file electioneering communication reports, let alone independent expenditure reports. So I don't know what you're supposed to do. Now, these drafts were released late. You haven't really had a chance to comment in writing. So I'm going to give you a sort of a broad opportunity here to comment orally if you so choose. But one issue I'd like you to try to struggle through with me to help me understand how this plays out as a practical matter is when you know you're going to have to file a report of some sort because you're going to run one of these ads within, you know, let's assume you're going to run one of these ads within a certain number of days in a geographic location that's going to trigger at least an EC report, which now we know post-Van Hollen may require some contributor information to be filed because you're not a political committee. But now all of a sudden maybe three commissioners are saying that, well, that's actually an independent expenditure, so maybe you do an IE report and you don't have to show contributors. It's making a hash of the statute. I don't understand how the commission can do this. And it seems to me that we have a reg that you already have the First Circuit that said it's beyond the Act. You have a district court that said it's beyond the Act. And I'm not sure we can even enforce a reg when you have, you know, a circuit split on a variety of different issues. It's not even really a circuit split because one circuit looks at it as a statutory matter. The other, you know, upholding it as constitutional doesn't mean it's within the Act. And I think of the best efforts case the commission had years ago where the D.C. Circuit said what the commission did wasn't unconstitutional, but it was beyond the Act. Emily's List raises the same issue. Part of the reg was beyond the Act. Part of the reg was within the Act but unconstitutional. The concurrence would have said the whole thing was beyond the Act. So there's this very real issue that the commission, I think, needs to deal with, and for whatever reason, it's just not dealing with it. And it leaves you, I think, in a spot where you really just, you want to speak. You're probably willing to file some sort of report. You just don't know which report to file, is my guess. But I'm going to give you a chance to maybe comment on generally the various drafts, and if you could address that concern of mine with some detail, I'd be curious because if I were you, I would have no idea what report to file.
The very reason that National Defense Committee is before this commission is to seek guidance. Are we going to first off, where are the regulatory lines? So we're asking questions about express advocacy. We're asking questions about political committee status. And beyond that, you know, are we filing Form 5? Are we doing a one-time independent expenditure report? Are we regular Form 3 filers with, you know, detailed schedules, H1 through H6. Are we doing the electioneering communications report if we trigger our certain aggregate amounts? We would prefer, of course, not to risk civil or criminal penalties for over $2,000 of expenditures where you willfully have not reported or registered with the commission, civil otherwise. And we believe that somewhere there's a category of speech that actually isn't regulated
by this commission. And the commission itself must be able to articulate a standard to the American public, to grassroots speakers who would like to be able to speak. And if it's unable to articulate that standard in a uniform, cohesive, and objective manner, then it is unreasonable to ask the American people to be able to understand how to comply with the very basic tenets of the federal election law. And here we are today.
But even certainly there are advertisements that are beyond the reach of the Federal Election Commission. And the commission is obligated to define that line. But there's areas that the Supreme Court has said are within the power of the government to regulate. That doesn't necessarily mean the statute reaches all areas that the government could regulate. But you're in a situation where you do have a statute with two different reporting regimes that says they're not the same thing. But yet you have a commission that has essentially said, well, but they can be, even though the statute says they can't be. I cannot understand how that can be and what you're supposed to do with this. I mean, it really gets muddy in draft B when you look at footnote 2, where it sort of tries to talk about that there's no campaign slogans being used. That's fine. And then it has a comparison site to Real Truth About Obama, citing the district court affirmed by the Fourth Circuit. And then it has this amazing sentence where it cites the district court, not the Fourth Circuit, where the district court found that the commission could constitutionally determine the advertisement to be express advocacy under B, noting that the tagline co-opts Obama's campaign slogan of change. But, of course, the Fourth Circuit didn't hold that. So we have an AO that seems to say the district court ruling that B reaches that ad is still the law when the Fourth Circuit, the way I read it, says the exact opposite. Doesn't make any sense to me. Do you have any comment on that particular footnote or how that plays out?
No, I haven't received the drafts at 8:30 last night. I haven't had a chance to analyze the veracity of the statements and analysis that's provided in that, only in the main text itself. So not at this point.
Although I would point out that, leaving aside the facts of that particular decision, if slogans are as susceptible to interpretation as broadly used a word as the word change, that there are probably some overbreadth problems in that approach to interpretation.
Yeah. Others have used the slogan forward.
I was not going to mention that, but yes.
Any other questions or comments? Commissioner Walther?
Just a couple of questions. On, you're asking us to opine on whether or not there's a political committee. Your budget is $3,000?
Yes.
And what percent of that is your overall budget, whether it includes this or dissimilar?
We're not providing the overall funding for the organization to the commission.
So this is only a part, but you won't mention how what percent of a part it is, even within a rough range?
No, we'd like to know where the line is. Is it 30%? Is it 51? Is it 66? The commission should be able to articulate that standard.
And so then, by dissimilar, does that mean it's not related at all?
Dissimilar, not related at all, and outside, we believe, outside of the reach of the Federal Election Campaign Act.
And so are you either is it all in the issue of communication, what the company does, or what else? What kind, can you say whether kind of activity there is, or is it just dissimilar to this? Is that the idea?
I think dissimilar to this is sufficient.
Okay. And your budget is just for this year?
The $3,000 that's noted is for 2012, yes.
And so we don't have any idea how much your budget would be made for similar things in the future?
No.
Is this the end of it? There's nothing more, again, will be like this? or will there be amounts in the future that will be spent?
We have no way of knowing when donors will contact us or members will urge the organization to speak out on issues.
Okay, so we're unable to say whether there would ever be any future activity or not of the kind we're talking about here.
Again, that's dependent upon funding and on the members' support for issues. So it's likely that the organization would speak out in the future, likely in small amounts, as are indicated here. But, you know, we don't know. There's changing tides. It could very well receive a large donation 10 years from now, 5 years from now. They could stop communicating entirely. I don't know. Right now, we'd like to speak moving up into the fall election and beyond, provided the commission allows us to or provides a standard that we can comply with.
We'd have to speculate. Would that be fair to say we'd have to speculate as to what it might be in the future?
We're not asking that question. So no speculation is
required. You're a momentary decision.
We're asking right now, how do we comply with the law?
Not to maybe continue to be a political committee after the election. Is that what you're talking about?
We don't know what January, February, March will hold. Okay. It's quite likely that something local or national might bob up that we speak about. Right. It may be that they don't speak for a year. We don't know that. Mm-hmm. We know that we want to speak right now. Right. We'd like to be able to comply with the law.
That's all I have.
Commissioner McGann.
So really where you're stuck is this idea that you're asking whether or not you're a political committee and therefore you have to disclose contributors and spending regardless of whether or not it's related to an election. And in order to get that answer, you're essentially seeing a draft that says you have to tell us all of that to let you, and then we can tell you whether you have to tell us all of that. It's circular. That can't be what the court in Buckley did when they limited the reach of the statute. That just doesn't make any sense. As a PAC, there must be some point in time where a PAC either exists or it doesn't exist. Citizens United made clear a PAC's its own entity, its own separate speaker. So the commission ought to be able to tell you whether or not you're a PAC at a given point in time. If there's insufficient facts, that means you're not a PAC. Because I've struggled with this since I've been here. Struggled with it before I got here, but it really came into focus once I was appointed and saw how the commission was really doing this up close and personal. In order to speak as a PAC, you need to have a treasurer and a bank account and file as a PAC. But we don't know if you're a PAC until after you speak. And then after we see everything else you did, we can tell you maybe you should have filed, maybe you shouldn't have filed, maybe you should have had a treasurer, maybe you shouldn't have had a treasurer, maybe you should have the best efforts for contributors, maybe you shouldn't have, maybe you had a corporate ban, maybe you didn't, maybe you had a foreign national ban, maybe you didn't. But you're not going to know that apparently until long after the fact. Commission's not doing its job if that's really how this plays out. Now, to play devil's advocate, you do have court cases that say it's a comparative or have confirmed, you know, the idea that it's a comparative, which is all true. But what do you compare? Is it everything you're doing as a private person, or is it just campaign spending? And once we know it's going to be insufficient, or is it how do we do major purpose? Is it publicly available documents and spending that is clearly campaign spending, meaning as defined by Buckley and MCFL. A number of circuit courts seem to say that. In fact, the one most recent decision to deal with the FEC's policy certainly upheld the idea of case by case as a constitutional matter, but the gloss they put on the major purpose test differs radically from what the commission had been doing in a number of MERS, much more narrow. Talks about discovery, and you don't really, the commission doesn't need to do much, if any. Seems to echo the language of the Chief Justice and WRTL. But yet here we are doing the same old thing. And we have this policy where we don't tell you until you tell us whether or not then you have to, and then once we tell you, you have to tell us the same thing you already told the government. It seems to be you have to become a political committee to find out whether or not you're a political committee. Any thoughts on that, Mr. Parr?
The fact that federal courts have required a fact-intensive inquiry does not give sanction to a standardless or hidden inquiry. The commission is free to provide guidance as to an objective line, a dividing line, what percentage of an organization's expenditures or contributions that are regulated under the Act in contrast to its overall budget might trigger political committee status. It's free to provide all these triggers so that organizations don't have to march in to the FEC, disclose all the information that they very well may like to keep private just so that they can have that constitutional privacy protected. That's the point that's here. We'd like to know up front. I fear that the major purpose test is interpreted at times by the commission as being used as a means to circumvent the protections that we see very clearly in MCFL and Wisconsin Right to Life and Citizens United. We'd just like to know. We'd like to see your cards. Where is that line? Give us just bright line objective guidance as to how we can comply with the law and move forward so that we don't have this risk of sanction of penalties.
Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sure everybody's very entertained by the, isn't this so? Why, yes, it's so, discussion so far. Just a couple of points. There's been the suggestion that it's not enough to name a candidate. You actually have to identify the candidate qua candidate. I'm not aware of that being the rule. It's certainly not, you know, our regulation, for example, says that a picture will suffice to clearly identify the candidate, and it doesn't say, but it's got to have a caption underneath that says candidate underneath it, just the picture that clearly identifies the person. So if you mention a clearly identified candidate by name in the ad, I think you're there fairly clearly under our regulation. It's also been suggested that somehow doing an analysis in which the ad is quoted is somehow rewriting the ad. I guess the theory would be that only if we quote the entire ad in toto all the time, in every sentence, would we not be rewriting the ad, which seems to me kind of silly. As my colleague points out, the courts have endorsed the notion of our doing political committee on a case-by-case basis. It seems to me that you're asking the same thing that the commission has been challenged by in court before, challenged on in court before, saying, you know, we want you to set out a political committee rule that's going to have a lot of detail in it so that we don't have to provide you with any information in order for you to make a case-by-case determination. But the court said, no, you can do it on a case-by-case basis. In order to do it on a case-by-case basis, we have to have some information. You don't want to give us the information, okay, but then we can't make the determination. And again, because people love to talk about speech bans, can't seem to resist. Nobody's talking about any kind of a speech ban. We're only talking about reporting. Oh, it was also suggested that you might have to file EC reports, but as I read your request, you're only planning on posting these ads on the Internet or on social media sites. That's not covered under the EC provision of the statute. So unless you're going to run some broadcast ads somewhere, I don't see any circumstance in which you'd have to file an EC report. The major purpose test is, by its nature, quantitative. It's your purpose, the major purpose. That's a quantitative notion. So if we don't know quantitatively what sorts of activities or even the ratio of activities that you're planning, it's hard for us to make that determination. And it's not the case that we're asking you for everything that you'd have to file if you were a political committee, because then you'd have to file reports on all of your donors and all of your expenditures. I'm not aware of you being asked for any information on your donors in this context, but I think without some sense of scope of activity, we're going to do this much of this and that much of that, and here's what, generally what we're going to do. I don't know that it has to be terribly detailed, but I think we have to have some information on it in order to make that case-by-case determination, you know, which is in its by nature case-by-case. That means based on your facts, not, you know, based on no facts at all, which seems to be the way you want us to make it. I don't know if I really have much else to say, but you know, it's very easy to say that no one's going to be a political committee if you never find express advocacy. You know, if nothing is ever express advocacy, then nobody ever becomes a political committee. So that's a fairly easy analysis, but some of us aren't really comfortable with that. So at whatever juncture you think is appropriate, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to make a motion to move this along.
Thank you. Any other comments? Commissioner McGann?
Yeah, I need to sort of debunk the straw men that have been erected and then torched. It is true that the ad does not identify anyone as a candidate. If it did say candidate so-and-so, that would be probably a different, slightly different analysis as to whether the ad contains express advocacy because, well, when you actually expressly refer to the election or someone as a candidate or that sort of thing, at least in the Ninth Circuit, all that seems to matter. The point I was making is a factual matter. The ad does not in any way, shape, or form call the person a candidate. On the contrary, it calls the person representative or congresswoman, and it talks about legislation. So, yes, the reg requires referring to the person as a candidate. The law, I guess, does not require you to say candidate so-and-so. The name is enough. But there are MERS, and I'm thinking, I think it's the Wiley brothers MER, where the Office of General Counsel wrote a report. It was regarding a Bush and a McCain primary ads, and it was significant that it did not refer to either one as a candidate. It's right in the counsel report. Now, when it went to the commission, it went 3-3. This was before the supposed 3-3 gang showed up. This was, you know, there's always been 3-3s on things. This was in the golden age of compromise. It still went 3-3. So my point wasn't to say that legally this isn't referencing a candidate. It's a factual matter that it's not saying that they're a candidate, which is something that a number of commissioners and the general counsel and courts have found to be probative over the years. So it's an example of rewriting the ads, morph into the conclusion one seeks, which brings me to the second point. It's easy to say, well, I must be suggesting you have to quote the ad in full. I'm not. Let's just quote it in the order that the speaker presents it and not take quotes and tag them to other parts of sentences and that sort of thing. It's really up to those either listening to this or reading these drafts to determine whether or not the ads are being rewritten to come within the reach of a reg or not. I think they are. The case by case, let's not get too confident about it's been endorsed by courts and upheld. It was challenged on an APA ground, and district court said for APA purposes that works, but the court also said very clearly not ruling on constitutional or other challenges. A plaintiff challenged it in Real Truth About Obama, which I guess they've been renamed Real Truth About Abortion. And the Fourth Circuit said, confirmed, they were not a political committee. So to take that case and say that how the commission's been doing things is now been given the thumbs up and this is how it's going to be, I think is a stretch because there's a case where someone tried to bring an as-applied challenge to the policy and the court said, well, you're not a political committee, so go away and be free. Now, if the court had held they were a political committee, that would be a different situation. But you go back and look at the GOPAC case, which, by the way, was cited by the Fourth Circuit. So I sort of read GOPAC as now a quasi-Fourth Circuit case where the commission took a very expansive view of its powers, a very expansive discovery, and went to court and was shellacked. Judge Orbitover couldn't have been clearer in that opinion. The commission was just wrong. But yet that opinion never seems to really come up in the discourse. So I wouldn't get too excited that the commission has smooth sailing on this case-by-case thing because there still remains the problem, which still was not addressed here today, of this circular problem where you have to tell us a lot of things that you otherwise probably wouldn't want to tell us
to figure out whether or not you have to tell us via report. It's still the same circular problem. It exists. Now, whether you want to play on the margins and say you don't have to tell us everything you'd have to put on a report for a political committee, maybe that's true. You don't have to give us every contributor's name at this stage. But it still does seem to be that the law requires you to set up as a political committee to speak in certain instances, and if you don't know you have to do that, then you can't speak, which brings me to what is really a red herring, which is the idea of a ban. No one's mentioned a ban until a moment ago, and it's I really, for the life of me, don't understand what that has to do with, you know, the disclosure versus ban thing. Okay, for constitutional purposes, as to what the government can regulate versus ban, they can regulate more via via disclosure than they can ban. That's all it gets you. Buckley dealt with the disclosure the disclosure mandates of FECA just as they did for the ban. And when they limited the reach of Buckley, it wasn't just because of a speech ban. It wasn't because there was a corporate ban and they were going to limit the reach of the expenditure ban to only express words of advocacy. That also applies to the disclosure provisions. The opinion could not be clearer on the point. And to the extent that someone says, well, Congress changed the law after Buckley, Congress could not have been clearer that they codified Buckley. It's right in the legislative history. And to the extent someone says, well, it's still a new statute, we get to go again, MCFL construed the act invoking Buckley. And then if you still aren't clear about it, McConnell uses Buckley and MCFL almost interchangeably. So this idea of speech ban is kind of a red herring. It's the same rule whether one bans or discloses when it comes to what's an expenditure. I don't see anything in the case law that said Buckley or MCFL has been relaxed. What I do see is a Fourth Circuit case that said, that answered a question kind of in the abstract as to whether the WRTL test is constitutional. Asked that way, the answer is going to be yes every time. When you ask the question, can the government use the WRTL test, which the Supreme Court has said is an objective test and is applied, other than the Supreme Court, everybody in the country has to answer that question in the affirmative. That doesn't really... That's a straw man to sort of put the ban in here. It's a shame. I did this a long time ago, urged the commission to revisit this whole issue because it really has made a hash. Yes, you're going to put these just on the internet, so therefore the EC report may not be required. The point I think I was making that I thought would have been obvious would be talking about the content of the ad. I'm assuming it goes on TV or radio and therefore would come within that statute. Whether it's on the internet or a mail piece or TV, it's still a fair point to say there's a difference between what's an expenditure that triggers an IE report and everything else. The fact that the IE reporting regime doesn't go as far as some would like and they want to stretch it, look, that's a fair point. Maybe it doesn't capture everything that it ought to capture. I think the Buckley Court decided that and erred on the side of freedom, not regulation. But Congress has already addressed this. Congress did not choose to go with an expansive know-it-when-you-see-it test on express advocacy or even political committee. They haven't touched political committee, even in McCain-Feingold. Instead, they put in the electioneering communication provision, which only applies to TV and radio and with other certain limiting criteria. Congress did not reach out and say the FEC is now statutorily empowered to impose a separate freestanding reporting obligation on internet ads because reasonable people can't disagree as to what the ad really means. Congress did not do that. Congress fixed the supposed problem of the shortcomings of Buckley and MCFL with the electioneering communication business. Ban and a reporting regime, depending on who you were. The ban's been struck. The reporting regime remains. But to the extent there's any shortcomings of the IE reporting regime, Congress has addressed that. It's not up to the commission to do it. And the more the commission tries to fix the problems on its own without legislative warrant, the more it's making a mess of disclosure. And the more you're going to have situations where you're going to have people reporting things. I'm going to stay consistent even though it's very tempting to all of a sudden say, oh, express advocacy covers all kinds of things, because that'll push the electioneering communication reporting regime and narrow it. But that's not how we play it here. The statute says what the statute says, and the commission needs to get back to the statute. And why it won't do it, I don't know, because it's been told time and time and time again to not ignore the statute in case after case after case after case. And although the commission has stayed one step ahead of the curve, time will catch up with the commission. I've seen too many MERS in the application of B go too many directions that it is not the language of B that's applied. It's essentially the post-WRTL multi-factor balancing test that was put into place by the commission, the very rule that was struck by Citizens United. And B is actually that times 10. I mean, that is just some of the factors that is used in B. And that cannot be disputed. The commission can try to say publicly however many times it wants that it's not a multi-factor test and it's limited to its language. It's not. And I'll tell you, looking at the analysis here, I see the same kind of thing. It's not as aggressive as some of the past efforts, but it's the same kind of a notion that simply because you mentioned the HR whatever, that doesn't change the essential nature of the act. That's nothing more than the whole safe harbor thing, and you have to prove you're not in electioneering communication by some affirmative legislative call to action. It's not the test for expenditure, but yet the commission keeps doing it. And the commission will probably get away with it for a little while longer. But there's going to come a time where this is going to come back to haunt the commission. And all I can say is I want to be publicly clear I'm not part of that.
Any other questions or comments? Madam Vice Chair?
I'm sure nobody would ever suggest that Commissioner McGann was part of anything that had anything to do with regulating anybody, actually. And you've been very clear about that, although I'm not sure what most of what you just said had to do with what came before, but that's okay.
Of course you don't understand it.
Well, that was rude.
Actually, not as rude as saying I have nothing to do with regulating anyone when I've served on the commission for 4 years and voted for penalties and voted to enforce the law and all that. So let's stop the straw men and posing for the cameras, and let's actually have a real discussion about what's before us today instead of, starting your speech last time with sarcasm about it's entertaining going back and forth. So there's nothing rude about what I said. I'm just suggesting we stick to the topic at hand.
Any other questions? Oh, Madam Vice Chair.
I don't think this kind of I'm right, you're wrong, and, it's going to come home to roost, and maybe not right away, but someday all the courts are going to agree with me. What I've seen in the courts is sometimes they agree with one commissioner's view of the law, and sometimes they agree with another commissioner's view of the law. Point out, by the way, that on the subject of the major purpose test, the Fourth Circuit recently concluded that the Commission in its policy adopted a sensible approach to determining whether an organization qualifies for PAC status. And more importantly, the Commission's multi-factor major purpose test is consistent with Supreme Court precedent and does not unlawfully deter protected speech. Accordingly, we find the policy constitutional. So, maybe it's a little bit clearer than has been suggested, at least in one circuit. But I don't really think this is helping anybody. So I would like to move that we adopt agenda document 12-63A, which is draft B. Got to work on that numbering system. In response to the National Defense Committee's request. I with one very slight edit, actually, just to clarify the sentence on page 2 at the top, I would include in my motion that we insert the words that it between and is on line 3, so that it would read, the sentence would read, at that point, and that it is not affiliated with any group that makes contributions, just to clarify the sentence.
Commissioner Bowerly.
If I might just add one thing on the motion.
Sure.
Okay. I will be supporting this motion because I believe it does the proper job of applying the Act and the agency's regulations. And I have serious concerns about the approach taken in Draft A, which seems to announce for the first time in an advisory opinion the Commission is declining to apply and enforce one of its own rules. As Draft B notes in a footnote, the agency needs to apply its own regulations until a court has finally determined that they cannot be applied. And in 1995, the D.C. Circuit explained that it would be contrary to law if the Commission refused to enforce refusal to enforce would be based not on a dispute over the meaning or applicability of the clear terms, but on the Commission's unwillingness to enforce its own rule. And so while this Commission and previous commissioners have disagreed over the applicability of 122B, I believe that at this point in time, it is the Commission's duty to apply it, and we have in Draft B, so I'll be supporting it.
Commissioner McGann?
Question on that point. We have a First Circuit Court of Appeals case that the FEC lost, striking B, and a district court opinion out of New York. Are you suggesting that B can still be enforced there, even though the Commission had publicly said it wasn't going to enforce B, at least in the First Circuit? I don't follow this reference to the 95 case about we have a duty to enforce a reg when I see a reg that has been struck, at least in part of the country, and the same circuit that you cite has been clear and has frowned upon intra-circuit non-acquiescence and inter-circuit non-acquiescence, but it's really come down hard in intra-circuit. So are we actually doing intra-circuit non-acquiescence? Because I would assume these are Internet ads. They can be seen in the First Circuit, unless there's been some new technology that somehow can draw Internet lines around certain courthouses. But I'm unaware of that. I'm curious on how this – are we just ignoring the First Circuit? How do we enforce the reg, as you suggest, that we must?
As the Commission has explained numerous times, subsequent cases, including in the Fourth Circuit, have explained that in the Fourth Circuit was, of course, one of the circuits that called into question 122B, if so subsequently identified the validity of the regulation.
I don't understand that. I'm sorry.
Well, I didn't have a chance to write 53 pages on inter-circuit non-acquiescence, but
I got thrown into, but you did tell the House Admin Committee that the Commission doesn't practice it anymore. So that's why I'm curious as to what the position is. What threw me and what sort of just, when you said the circuits have called in the question, B, they didn't call in the question. They said it was not enforceable. The Fourth had tied it to constitutionality. Mm-hmm. The First had tied it to being beyond the Act. If the First Circuit says a reg is beyond the Act, how can we enforce it in that circuit? Particularly when the circuit you cite that says we have this duty to enforce regs has also said inter-circuit non-acquiescence is a bad idea and intra-circuit non-acquiescence is a really, really bad idea. And I think it was Abner Mikva that wrote the opinion that said that. It was a long time ago. So I don't understand how we enforce a reg in parts of the country where it's been struck.
As the Commission has explained in its recent briefing in Real Truth About Abortion, as I believe it's called now, subsequent cases out of the circuit and the Supreme Court while I would agree they haven't explicitly overruled the First Circuit case, have modified the understanding of what the status of that regulation is.
See, but the briefs that the Commission filed dealt with the constitutional issue and, in fact, said the statutory argument for purposes of the Fourth Circuit case was, to use OGC's word, make weight, because it wasn't really raised by the plaintiff. The plaintiff did it as a constitutional challenge. I'm asking about the challenge that B is beyond the reach of the statute, which is the holding of the First Circuit. I don't understand how what the Commission did in briefs arguing about the constitutionality of B
In those briefs, the commission said GB and WRTL are basically the same thing, which in my view has made a hash of the reporting regime. But I don't see how any of that has anything to do with whether or not B comes within the reach of the statute, particularly when the Supreme Court in McConnell said they weren't revisiting Buckley. Buckley was a case of statutory construction. And even Colarcatelli, as it was going up, said statutory construction, be, you know, beyond the statute. She kind of bit down hard on that argument, and that was the predicate for why the Supreme Court opinion ended up looking the way it looked. I don't understand how anything that's happened subsequent to the First Circuit case has changed the First Circuit case's holding. And even if there's an argument that it did, second question is, how does the commission have the power just to ignore First Circuit decision when it turns on a different ground than what the Fourth Circuit just said?
I think that it's fair to say in all of these issues, the constitutionality and the statutory construction, as you've pointed out numerous times, Buckley is a statutory construction, but also closely intertwined with the constitutional analysis that's required by the First Amendment. I don't think that in any of the cases addressing FECA, they are never just straight statutory construction cases. They are always underpinned with the gloss of the First Amendment because that is the area being regulated.
Shays 1, 2, and 3, that wasn't constitutional. That was APA, beyond the Act, inconsistent with the Act.
Certainly, so agency action.
There's a lot of cases in the FEC that have nothing to do with constitutional law.
And yet, I frequently hear my colleagues tell us that we must be always cognizant of the First Amendment and the statutory limits of this agency's power, and the tie goes to the Speaker. And so, this agency is charged with regulating in a different area than many other federal agencies. So, I don't know that this is a productive conversation. You've said your piece in your draft with respect to your view of the circuit split that is at issue here. I disagree, and I'll be supporting draft B. The commission has been defending this regulation in court, and I think that we need to continue to enforce it. Again, there not to say that this has been that there haven't been disagreements over its how it applies in particular cases, but I think, in my view, there's no doubt that that we need to continue to apply it, and as the requester has asked us to.
Commissioner McGann?
Whether or not it's a productive discussion is beside the point. You were the one that raised and highlighted the fact that a draft, I guess you're not going to support, answers the question asked by the requester about the enforceability of B. And I still haven't heard an answer as to why the commission can ignore the First Circuit case that held that the reg was beyond the reach of the statute. Merely because the commission defended against a declaratory challenge in the Fourth Circuit, when the prior Fourth Circuit case law turned on constitutional grounds, is wholly different. Recall, after Fergatch, the First Circuit rejected Fergatch out of hand. The Fourth Circuit didn't really reject Fergatch out of hand. They said B went beyond Fergatch and therefore was unconstitutional and got kind of vague. And then the second time around, they said, well, if B is the same as WRTL, then it's constitutional. So I think this is, to me, it's a productive conversation. But whether it is or isn't, I'm responding to a point you were making and asking a question about how, given that you're saying we have to enforce B and it would be essentially a dereliction of my duty, says a court from 1995, to do otherwise, how can I do that when I'm looking at another circuit court case telling me the reg is unenforceable? Are you telling me I'm empowered to ignore the First Circuit Court of Appeals within the First Circuit? I have no authority where I can do that. If there is some, I'd be happy to look at it.
Okay. Seeing no other comments.
I got another one.
Get another one? Okay.
Yeah, if we're not going to continue that one, I want to make sure we're clear on, this is a point when the vice chair pulled out the Fourth Circuit opinion and read it and said it's been upheld. The standard of major purpose is nomination
or election of a federal candidate, or is it the more amorphous campaign activity or federal campaign activity or federal stuff? Because what the Fourth Circuit upheld was the policy adopted by the commission, which tracks the language of Buckley, nomination or election of a federal candidate. But if you look at the MERS and statements of reasons offered by several of the current commissioners, you see the standard is not so narrow. It actually is the more amorphous campaign activity and includes what some of us would call issue ads and what some of us would call things that are not unambiguously campaign-related ads, a la express advocacy. Some may want to count electioneering communications. Who knows? So I want to make sure, because B seems to be this language tracking Buckley. That is different from what a number of MERS and statements of reasons have said the standard is, and I just want to make sure I'm clear that maybe this is a new day, because since the commission, in defending the major purpose test, tracked the Buckley language and not the language it used in MERS, but used the Buckley language, and that was upheld, we now agree that we are back to the more narrow version of the major purpose test, not the MER version of the major purpose test.
Madam Vice Chair.
I made a motion to support a draft. The draft contains discussion of the major purpose test. I'm not really prepared here to have a wide-ranging discussion of every enforcement action that has also discussed the major purpose test. It's not relevant to this request. The requester's asked a question. I'm just trying to at least get votes on the record on what different commissioners think the answer ought to be.
Commissioner McGann.
The policy the commission adopted, though, on the major purpose references MERS and claims that the case by case will be in, the public can be informed by MERS. So I think I'm not bringing something in to the draft that's not in the draft. By invoking the policy, you are invoking MERS. For example, Unity 08 was decided under the commission's case by case approach, and that was reversed in court. But yet the commission has done nothing to explain to the public on how that affects its case-by-case approach. So what I'm asking is, are we using the Buckley construction or are we using the MER-driven construction? Because the policy does use the Buckley construction but then invokes MERS, that at least one of which has been, and I would argue several of which, but certainly one of which was decided under that policy incorrectly.
Vice Chair.
There's roughly two-page discussion in draft B of what the major purpose is. That's the document that is before us. That's what we're moving today. We're not having a rulemaking. We're not discussing every MER that's ever been decided. Here's the language. If you want to know what we're voting on, that's what we're voting on.
Commissioner McGann.
Let me ask this. Given that the draft says that there's insufficient facts to determine the major purpose component, whether or not they're a political committee, what other facts would need to be known to the commission to make that determination, other than those currently in the record, meaning the ads and the solicitations?
Commissioner Walther.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This isn't the time for us to try and figure out what possible multiple iterations of different kinds of facts might be. So I think for us to try and do that today would be a misuse of a lot of our time. But all we have before us today is someone who wants to know if a $3,000 budget is going to put them in a position of being possibly a political committee. No information about the future, no information about the rest of the budget, no information about, how big the budget is or what they might plan in the future. It's all speculative. So if we were to dive one way or the other on it at this point, it would be, I think, pretty irresponsible.
Mr. McGann.
But how can the draft say that the commission has insufficient facts to decide and then on the other hand say it's irresponsible to articulate what those facts would be. Are we saying that you really can't get an advisory opinion on whether or not you're a political committee? I'm at a loss here because I don't understand. They're here to get guidance. They ask the question. They haven't told us everything they're doing. They agree that they're not telling us everything that they're doing. What else do they need to tell us for the commission to make a decision, short of telling us everything that they're going to do, regardless of whether it's related to federal elections, directly, indirectly, or however one wants to characterize it versus not? It's a simple question. Major purpose is comparative. We all agree on that. What are we comparing? And if this requester wants to get guidance and come back with additional facts, what would those additional facts be? And if we can't say what those additional facts are, then there is no rule, and we are just going to let things happen and then after the fact judge. And that can't be the case. Not for a reporting regime. You can't have a reporting regime that we're going to decide after the conduct occurs, oh, you should have reported. You need to know at the time you speak whether or not there's a reporting obligation. What facts do they need to tell us that we can decide that question?
We were given 55 pages to read from midnight last night. I haven't completed that, but if we want to get into that discussion, I don't think we do, then I would move that we put this off until a future date before we hear it.
Madam Vice Chair.
I'm not prepared today or any other day to have a rulemaking in the guise of this advisory opinion. Our counsel's office, I don't have the email in front of me, but our counsel's office posed some questions to requester and said, if you want to have that question answered, here's what we would need to know. They declined to answer. The draft states, in determining an organization's major purpose, the commission considers, among other factors, how much an organization spends on federal campaign activity compared to activities that are not campaign-related. Since they're not prepared to give us any information, then, you know, that's we can't make that determination. It's not as if you're trying to probe the meaning of the draft to decide whether you're going to vote for it. You're not going to vote for it under any circumstances. Can't we just have our votes and move on?
Commissioner McGann.
Thank you, Saul Alinsky, for attacking the motives of the speaker. I'm asking a real question on a very serious issue. Maybe I'll ask the general counsel, since now there is a request by the general counsel for additional facts. What additional facts did the general counsel think would have helped make this closer to something that could have been answered?
We had a series of conversations to try to cure what we viewed as deficiencies in the complaint. And during the course of those conversations... the request. And during the course of those conversations, we learned that there was a budget for other activities, and we sought information on the other budget activities by category, and that's when we were told that those activities were dissimilar and that the requester was declining to provide them to us. And the email that I think Madam Vice Chair was referring to is a supplement to the request. So it's at the back of the request where we consolidate some of that information.
Just for fun, what were some of the categories? These four categories.
We don't know. We weren't told.
Okay.
Madam Chair, may I comment on that point?
Sure.
We tried to pin down with particularity exactly what the FEC was asking for, and it was a frustrating discussion. We asked, was it a total budget? Was it for a year? Was it for 2 years? Was it for particular types of expenditures? Was it for this or that? We couldn't get a straight answer out of the FEC as to what they were exactly looking for, what would satisfy that threshold. And that's part of the reason why we're here as well and what's causing this up. Let us know where those lines are. What's A, B, C, D? I asked that very clearly to your counsel's office. I did not get a clear response.
There's no other questions or comments. There's a motion on the table made by the Vice Chair. to approve draft B. All those in favor?
I have a comment on that. I just want to say I'm tipping on both solicitation C and D. I'm going to support this draft, especially given the circumstances that we're under not today. But I do think those are a very close call, and might want to revisit that at some point in the future.
Commissioner McGann?
Can I ask a question about the solicitations? Under draft B, and it may not reach the question, it may reach the question, I'm not sure if it does. Any money received in response to the solicitations that the draft concludes are the sort of solicitations within the FEC's ability to regulate. Is all that money considered hard money, or is there any sort of thought as to the next step, as to what if the answer is that the solicitation is the sort of solicitation that solicits contributions, are all money received to that solicitation a contribution under the Act?
Call the question.
Okay. There's no. Okay. So we don't know, or we're not answering. Okay.
Okay. No other comments. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed?
No.
No. The motion fails 3-3. Thank you. Are there any other motions, Commissioner Peterson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd move approval of Draft A and Draft Advisory Opinion 2012-27. I would request that there be one small technical change on page 38, line 26. It currently reads, it jumps from, "and the Commander-in-Chief makes sure liberals will win this fall." Inadvertently, it left out a phrase. It should read, "and the Commander-in-Chief sits by," period, and then a dependent clause in building a $1 billion war chest, comma, and then proceeds from there. So I'd be happy to provide the technical change to General Counsel, but I'd like to incorporate that technical change as part of my motion in approving Draft A.
Thank you. All those in favor of Draft A?
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed?
No.
No.
The motion fails 3-3. We'd like to ask the Office of General Counsel to provide a letter to the requester signifying that there weren't four votes for either draft.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Thank you for coming in this morning.
Thank you.
Appreciate
it.
Madam Vice Chair?
Do you want to have them attempt to? There were some substantive answers, at least, that we came to the same conclusion on. Do you want them to try and put that in the letter?
I suppose we could try to do that. I guess I was just thinking that the reasoning behind those were so different that I'm not sure that that's a fruitful, if that's helpful to the requester.
Well, I mean, to the extent that it says, you know, I mean, he's asked, are a series of communications express advocacy, to the extent we could say yay or nay and actually give you six votes on a couple of them. And, well, it would be on the nays. But I would think that would be it would be answering his question.
Would that be something that the Office of General Counsel would be able to do today?
Yes.
Okay. All right. We'll give that a try. If that doesn't work, we'll have the letter. Thank you very much. The next matter on the agenda is Draft Advisory Opinion 2012-29, Hawaiian Airlines. Is Mr. Jacobs here? Hi there. Thank you for joining us today. A presentation from the Office of General Counsel, Mr. Tony Buckley.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Hunter. Good afternoon, Commissioners. Agenda documents 12-61 and 12-61-A contain draft advisory opinions that respond to requests submitted on behalf of Hawaiian Airlines Incorporated. Hawaiian provides inter-island flights and nonstop service between Hawaii and the U.S. mainland, Australia, and Asia. Its operations are closely linked to other members of the travel and tourism industry in Hawaii, such as hotels, restaurants, tour operators, and their vendors. Hawaiian Airlines Incorporated Political Action Committee is a separate segregated fund of Hawaiian Airlines. Hawaiian intends to organize events that individually will feature both the general election both of the general election candidates for the 2012 election to the U.S. Senate from Hawaii. The events will include breakfast followed by a discussion. Hawaiian plans to invite members of its restricted class and leaders in the Hawaii travel and tourism industry to the events. Draft A, contained in Agenda Document 12-61, concludes that Hawaiian may not conduct its events as described. Draft A determines that doing so would provide things of value to the candidates, which would be illegal corporate contributions, and that the presence of the members of Hawaii's travel and tourism industry take the events outside of any of the exceptions at 11 CFR 114.3 or 114.4. Draft B, contained in Agenda Document 12-61-A, concludes that Hawaiian may conduct its events. Draft B determines that because the members of Hawaii's travel and tourism industry would be participating in the event, they would fall within the exception to the ban on corporate contributions at 11 CFR 114.3 C2 Romanet 1. The Commission received no comments on the request and one comment on the drafts. I am happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Buckley. Any questions this morning for Mr. Jacobs this afternoon? Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Quick question of Mr. Jacobs. Some of the drafts got out rather late yesterday, which gave you limited time in order to comment on them, and you did give us an appreciate getting those comments to us under the wire. I imagine they may not have been as expansive as maybe as you wanted to. I've only had limited opportunity to really parse through them, and so I wanted to give you an opportunity to kind of explain whatever questions or concerns you have regarding the competing drafts that were put out on Blue yesterday.
Great. Thank you, Commissioner Peterson. I think Draft A decides that the events would not include participation by the those outside of Hawaiian's restricted class, by the other executives from the travel and tourism industry. The events are designed to be an interactive forum. It's a small group. It's 20 to 30 people. They're business executives. They're not being invited to come hear the candidates just speak. This is a situation where they are being that the events are designed to really elicit discussion between the candidates on tourism and other issues. That's not limited to just a discussion about the tourism industry. I think the idea that they are not participating stretches, or at least it minimizes that regulation and the exception there, to something that does not seem to be contemplated when you look at the rulemaking history. The advisory opinion that was cited in as a comparison involved a 1,000-person conference where the candidates were going to speak, and there was not going to be an opportunity to discuss or ask any questions of the candidates. I think that there's a 1,000-participant conference over here and a 20 to 30-person roundtable discussion on our side here. There's a line somewhere in between. I don't think the commission has to necessarily define exactly that line today, but certainly we believe that our situation is much more participatory under the regulation than perhaps the 1,000-person conference, and that it would be a fairly simple, I think, decision to say that this is participation. There's going to be a give and take and a two-way discussion here. It's not simply the candidate giving a speech. It would provide a lot of clarity to organizations that would like to be able to have events like this, quite frankly. Thank you.
So this really, I mean, the traditional event we often think about in terms of speaker and, you know, active speaker, passive audience. And this, according to your representation, is where you will have candidates there, but they're one of how many you have, you know, 20, 30, 40, all kind of on equal footing, so to speak. One's not intended to kind of be the dominating voice, and the others are just supposed to sit back and listen. You imagine a dynamic exchange with everybody basically on equal footing.
That's right. These are high-level executives in Hawaii in the travel and tourism industry. They're all, as I understand it, fairly equal executives in various companies. The idea would not be for one person to sort of lead the discussion, but really they're going to be around a table, so a breakfast table, they're going to be interacting with the candidate equally. Perhaps one person may not ask as many questions as others, but there's certainly the intention of inviting these folks is that they're all going to actively be engaged in the discussion.
Okay. And also in your comments, you mentioned when you gave the request, you focused more on 14.4. But as I read your comments, the language in 114.3 is equally applicable in terms of they also have an exception for participants, but that you had a particular, because of the particular details of the event that you were planning, you couch this under 114.4 instead.
That's right. There's a lot of overlap, I think, between the two regulations. There's also some differences. And the event that Hawaiian plans would be with Hawaiian's restricted class employees. But the two events, when you look at sort of what the factors are that are present between 0.4 and 0.3, we suggested 0.3 would work, but either works because they're restricted class only personnel here, except for the other folks who are attending from the other companies.
Okay. And just to the extent that you'd like to offer, do you see anything in what the commission has said before in its advisory opinion process that would foreclose what you're planning on doing here today?
No, I don't think so. As I said, the advisory opinion that was the focus of Draft A was a far different event than what we have planned, and so I don't see that it would be controlling. The facts are materially different.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess we just disagree on what was within the contemplation of the regulation and what participation was intended to mean. Those of us who will be supporting Draft A think it actually did mean something, you know, being on the program, being having a more elevated role than what I hear described. I'm not saying this is a terrible idea. I'd be open to looking at the regulations and seeing if we could modify them to allow for events like this. I mean, it's not I think the regulation anticipated that there would be mostly restricted class people and then maybe a couple of others who might be providing information to them. And here, in fact, as I understand the request, more people would be outside the restricted class than inside the restricted class. It's just it's a different animal, I think, than what was contemplated. And, you know, it's not, as I said, I don't have any objection to our taking another look at these regulations, but I don't personally think that what you describe is covered, is permitted under our regulations. So I'll be supporting Draft A.
Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a quick question for those who are supporting Draft A. It deals with Advisory Opinion 1999-2, Primera Blue Cross. On page 5, you do cite to it for the proposition that invitations extended to multiple candidates for the same office or invitations extended to candidates, qua candidates, established at the event planned is, in fact, in connection with the federal election. But I went back and looked at that. That was a 114.4 analysis in that advisory opinion where the commission ultimately said that you may the corporation could foot the costs. This was extended beyond the restricted class. And in fact, if anything, the events themselves were much more candidate-centered. These were considered candidate forums. They were restricted in their ability to engage in express advocacy, to engage in any sort of campaign-related speech. It couldn't solicit. But the commission ultimately said that the corporation could foot the bill for both the event and an associated lunch, which would involve the candidates. And I was just when I didn't dive into the details in excruciating detail, but when I read that, I was wondering if there was some distinction you saw between the facts as presented by Hawaiian as that made that not as applicable in this particular case, that particular AO. And I apologize that I haven't brought this before. This was something that I basically caught in the gap between our earlier hearing and this meeting. So,
Madam Vice Chair,
I'm not looking to Springer. I just have that question.
It's been a busy day. You know, we cite that AO for the quoted proposition. You know, is it different in some ways? Yes, but does that make a difference to our answer? Ultimately, no. But like I said, I'm willing to reconsider in the rulemaking context.
Any other questions or comments? Are there any motions? Commissioner Peterson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move approval of agenda document number 12-61-A, which is otherwise known as Draft B, with respect to Draft Advisory Opinion 2012-29.
Thank you. All those in favor? Aye. Opposed?
No.
The motion fails 3-3. Any other motions? Madam Vice Chair?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move approval of Draft A, which is set forth in agenda document number 12-61.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion also fails 3-3. So the Office of General Counsel will send a letter to Hawaiian Airlines noting that there weren't four votes for either of the drafts. Mr. Jacobs, thank you very much for coming in today.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. The next matter on the agenda is Draft Advisory Opinion 2012-30, Revolution Messaging. And we have Mr. Neil Reif and Ms. Elizabeth Howard joining us this afternoon. Thank you for coming. We have a presentation from the Office of General Counsel, Ms. Joanna Wallstriker.
Thank you, Chair Hunter. Good afternoon, Commissioners. Agenda document 12-62 is a draft response to an advisory opinion request submitted by Revolution Messaging, LLC. As an application provider of text messaging services, Revolution Messaging administers mobile communications programs. The request asks the Commission whether two elements of a proposal to allow wireless users to make contributions by text message comply with the Act and the Commission regulations. First, the requester proposes to allow users to make contributions by text message, aggregating in excess of $50 per month and $200 per calendar year or election cycle, so long as the users provide identifying information to Revolution Messaging, which it will then provide to the recipient political committees. Second, the requester proposes to allow political committees to share common short codes that are used to designate the recipient of a contribution made by text message by assigning unique keywords to each political committee. The draft concludes that the proposal complies with the Act and Commission regulations. The proposal will allow political committees to comply with the record-keeping and reporting provisions of the Act and Commission regulations. The proposal to use shared common short codes in combination with unique keywords will effectively segregate contributions to a given political committee from other funds. We did not receive any comments on the request, and we received one comment on the draft. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions or comments for Mr. Reif or Ms. Howard? Commissioner McGinn.
Thank you. Your client is Revolution. The draft concludes with question one. It says, Commission concludes, therefore, that the proposal described above will comply with the record-keeping and reporting requirements of the Act and Commission regulations. Your client actually doesn't have any record-keeping and reporting requirements under the Act. Your client's clients have record-keeping and reporting obligations, and it seems like you're taking on or helping those, we'll call them customers, with best efforts and the like. The concern I have with this AO, and I've had with some of the previous AOs, is treasurers of committees being able to comply, file reports, get the information they need and whatnot. Is the intent of the AO to have a piece of paper that then will also protect your customers?
We are obviously trying to come up. We've come up with a workflow here that we believe is compliant with the Act. And, of course, we want to give the clients of Revolution Messaging assurances that that workflow and process complies with the Act.
Okay. I agree it works under the Act. My concern is the reach of the AO protection, because it's not clear that it would extend. It sort of says it, but not as clearly as I think it could. It doesn't make sense to say that it complies with record-keeping and reporting requirements if it doesn't apply to those who have record-keeping and reporting requirements.
Well, you could certainly add that as clarification.
Okay. That's my only question for
council. Okay. Any other questions or comments?
We got a comment.
Yep, Commissioner Wells.
We just got a comment a little earlier by CTIA. Do you have any comment on that?
Absolutely. We believe that the use of common short codes has been prevalent in the industry for many years. So we believe the comment is overstated in terms of their argument that there it's confusion and that each committee should have its own short code.
Do you do anything to see if any short code that somebody's using is confusingly similar with somebody else's short code? I mean, I see where this is done. Where I guess Mobile Giving Foundation has 12 short codes used for over 1,000 different programs. So, I mean, I know it's not a strange thing the way you're proposing it, but is there some way to alleviate a possibility of confusion?
Well, it's not the short code that causes the confusion. It's the use of the keyword. The keyword, and if you notice in our request, we said a couple of things. First of all, we are going to notify all of our clients that they're on a common short code. So there'll be an opportunity to be a cross-vetting amongst clients to make sure there is no confusion.
How would they do that?
Well, we would also, if there was even a remote chance that a short code was, or name of a candidate was close or similar, like Warner, we would make sure that the keywords were sufficiently different so there would be no confusion. We have full control over that.
Okay, so you actually are in a position to deal with that problem.
Absolutely.
That's all I had.
Commissioner McGann?
On the short code issue, the comment that came in, the way I take it is ultimately it's still up to the CTIA folks, meaning the phone companies, as to whether or not you're going to be able to do short codes or how many short codes. I mean, they could, for their business model, decide, right? And I think
absolutely.
We had given them a clean yes, I thought, on that point. There's been some subsequent comments in the press.
No, I think that issue was addressed in the MCUBE 2 and also in the CTI advisory opinion. And we didn't obviously ask for any clarification of that in our request.
Okay. The draft, as it sits before us, though, a question two, there's a paragraph, page 11, begins line 16. First paragraph says yes, it's a simple yes and yes to the question, but then the paragraph, corporate vendors must generally maintain separate accounts and segregate contributions, that paragraph. It cites CTIA 1, which I thought was superseded, at least in part, by MCUBE, because the MCUBE AO actually has a footnote that talks about superseding AOs. It doesn't specify, but I certainly thought that's what we were doing at a minimum. The separate account concept is something that's been with the commission for a long, long time, but it seems to have been jettisoned, rightly so, I think, in MQ, because there are other ways to achieve the same goal, which is complying with the statute. There's nothing in the statute or the regs that says you have to have separate accounts as a vendor or a political consultant, right?
Right.
It's not like, the pipe fitters case that said that's a PAC and a union, that it's two separate concepts. But yet we still have this language in the draft, which I didn't really focus on until, kind of like Commissioner Peterson, the last one on the break, read it and said, I read it last night and I thought this is odd and I wanted to think about it. It seems like we're reinserting the separate account things unnecessarily, because the next sentence, page 12, first line, the use by a connection aggregator of common short codes to track contributions made via text messages to political committees achieves the goal of maintaining contributions and corporate funds in separate accounts. Well, it achieves the goal of ensuring corporate funds aren't going to campaigns, but it doesn't really achieve the goal of separate accounts. It's sort of separate accounting. It certainly achieves the goal of keeping the money separate, consistent with the law.
Sure.
But I have some concerns on the actual language of the AO, that this can be seen as a retreat from MCUBED and CTIA 2.
Yeah.
And notwithstanding what many see as a clean yes on CTIA 2, there's already some noise around that maybe it's not as clean as some of us had thought. So I'd like to throw it out to my colleagues if they would consider some edits to this part to tighten it up, because I'm not sure we need to really cite CTIA 1. If folks still think it's good law, that's their prerogative. I'm not sure it is, and we don't really need to reach that issue. But to me, it could be tighter, and the whole discussion of separate accounts. And before I throw it out to the commission, I'd like to ask Requester, do you have any reaction to that? Does that change your client's trying to achieve?
I'll point out that we didn't even discuss this issue in our request. We didn't discuss money flow at all. It wasn't something we were even requesting clarification on. We were not representing in our request that we would be acting as an aggregator, so it really isn't pertinent to our request.
The language is you wouldn't disagree. I won't make you agree, but you wouldn't disagree that paragraph, that sort of language, is not necessary.
I wouldn't disagree.
It's not language that you suggested. You don't disagree.
It is not, and I wouldn't disagree.
Okay.
Any other questions or comment, Madam Vice Chair?
I came in here today prepared to support the draft. I thought we were all going to support the draft. I think that the requester has come up with another way of using text messaging to promote political donations by small donors. I think that's a good goal. I think we've all agreed that's a good goal. And as we said in the M-Cube opinion, there's not only one way to skin that cat. So they came up with one way. You've come up with another way. It's all good. I'm not exactly clear because I appreciate it's been a busy week, but I was not this issue wasn't flagged for me until we were, literally about to walk into the room, so I'm not really sure what the edit even is that my colleagues are proposing.
Madam Chair, you mentioned whether we're going to vote today on this or not.
Right.
Are we or not?
Well, I think what we could do is circulate the edits. They've been described by Commissioner McGann. It's essentially deleting the paragraph that he referenced and maybe a couple of other sort of relatively minor changes. So we're happy to circulate that after the meeting and make it blue so that requester is able to see it as well. And then hopefully we can vote on a tally vote sometime in the near future.
Okay. I mean, I'm for this as it stands, but there's nothing wrong with making it better. So if that's the way you want to do it, I can support that.
Okay. Thank you. Commissioner
McGann. To preview a little more detail, page 11, lines 16 through 23, that paragraph, I don't think is necessary for what this AO is talking about, which is text messaging. And then the first sentence of the next paragraph would probably have to massage a little bit to make it flow a little bit better. So the edit is essentially crossing out that paragraph, and then, to the extent someone wants a footnote that says this doesn't alter past AOs regarding non-text messaging, so that people want to make clear we're not abandoning separate accounts, that's fine. But for text messaging, we've kind of already crossed the bridge of MQ. The other thing I'd like to throw out and get maybe take temperature now is how much cover can we give treasurers of committees. I don't want to tie up the requester on it, but on the other hand, in MQ1, there's a footnote that says the commission's not going to – we didn't answer the question in MQ1. We haven't answered it. And my concern is committees start getting various kinds of data in different forms, whether it's a list of phone numbers from one kind of business model or however you're going to present the best efforts data to your customers. I don't think it's the kind of situation where we can say to the committees or just assume they'll figure it out. I think what will happen is somebody will sign up for this. They won't be sure what to do. They'll start calling 694-1100. They may call RAD. They may get two different answers because, the commission hasn't given an answer. So to the extent we could at least in this AO make a little more clear that if a committee is a customer of Revolution and follows this model, they're also compliant, I think that would go a long way, because otherwise it's easy to say yes to this. But in other ways, it could be an illusory yes, because if the committees aren't comfortable, you're not necessarily getting your business objective.
Sure. That would certainly be appreciated. So
to the extent we can spiff that part up a little bit. I don't think it takes much, and I don't have specific language yet. And it could be if enough people at the table say it covers, maybe that's enough. But it'd be nice if we're in the AO somehow, that this will protect those who sign up for this service.
Sure.
Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I certainly support taking a little bit more time to make sure we get this right. And I also just wanted to address what Commissioner Walther brought up earlier, the comments that were brought in recently before our meeting by CTIA. Because the thing that flagged in my mind was we could approve this, but if those who ultimately are in charge of administering and handing out these short codes decided that they have real concerns, then it would be kind of a futile effort. And so I think taking a little bit of extra time to consider their comments and whatever subsequent comments they may submit to us, I think is something that I want to consider as well.
Madam Vice Chair.
I wonder if we could announce a time limit on that. I know CTIA said that they would like to comment further, but, you know, maybe we could give them a deadline, because I don't want to hold up the requester while we're waiting for somebody else to comment. You know, if we don't give a deadline, then who knows how long, you know, without a deadline, nobody ever gets anything done. So, I was prepared to vote for this today. I don't want to hold up this requester indefinitely. If we could, I had discussed with the chair whether maybe we could do this on tally next week. If we could, I mean, I don't know, I'm Monday, Tuesday, I don't know, you want to set a deadline?
I was going to say Tuesday or Wednesday. Did you have a comment, Mr.
No, I just want to emphasize that definitely the time is of the essence here, based upon the, you know, the election coming up so quickly and the amount of time it takes to get these things set up. So the sooner we can get this done, the better. And I do appreciate the commission expediting this. I really do appreciate that.
Thank you. Commissioner Bowerly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I too, was prepared to support this draft. I'm happy to look at edits along the line that Commissioner McGann talked about. I would note that I agree with Commissioner McGann for the first time today, maybe, but that as CTIA's comments points out, it still retains, as we described in very specific language, CTIA and its carriers retains the ability to set criteria based on its business practices or however we set it in that advisory opinion. And I don't think that anything about this request has an impact on it. It's not asking us to make any changes to that. I don't think that that there anything about what we say in this advisory opinion alters what happened, what we did in the advisory opinion request from last week. So I hope we can move this along as quickly as possible. I don't think that it's fair to one requester to hold it up for too long. If we want to set a comment deadline of next Monday or Tuesday and try to get this out by late next week, I would support that, and I think we should move as quickly as we can. So I'd support the chair's efforts in doing that. I also just wanted to make one comment about this particular request. I appreciate the requester's ingenuity and appropriate commitment to the idea of trying to help these committees get as much of this information as possible so that they can meet their disclosure requirements. And I think this request demonstrates that fostering more engagement from people is not incompatible with transparency and disclosure. So I want to commend your client on those efforts. And like I said, this will all be dependent, of course, upon the carriers setting up this criteria, and that, of course, will take some time. So I do hope that we can move along as quickly as we're able to.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I just wanted to comment on Commissioner Bowerly's point that just like in the CTIA and the MCUB advisory opinions, there were a lot of discussion about things that the commission determined had nothing to do with the disposition of the advisory opinion. And I think the same applies here, that the issues being raised by CTIA here, while they may be issues with regard to the industry, they really have nothing to do with the disposition of this advisory opinion.
Okay. Thank you. So maybe we could let CTIA know that they have until Tuesday, sort of the compromise date. I think that's August 28th, to comment on this advisory opinion. In the meantime, we'll circulate and make public the edits that we've described here today and plan to vote on a tally vote soon.
Madam Chair, in addition to CTIA, though, shouldn't we make a press release come out today saying that we are going to extend the time for comment until next Tuesday or something like that?
Sure.
So anybody can,
yes,
including the requester.
I just wanted to make sure they knew that there was a hard deadline. I don't believe they're here today, but yes, absolutely. Anybody else who wants to comment is certainly free to do so as well.
So just to clarify for anybody who's listening, we're saying Tuesday?
Yes.
Okay.
Tuesday, which I think is August 28th.
I have a question. Are we saying Tuesday to comment on a new draft, or what do we comment to comment on what exactly by Tuesday?
On the old draft, the new draft, the comment that was filed, whatever.
Got it.
So anything.
So we would expect a new draft, obviously, in the next 24, 48 hours. And
yes.
Okay.
Anything else? Okay. Thank you very much. Thanks for coming this afternoon.
Thank you.
The next matter on the agenda is the Audit Division Recommendation Memorandum on the National Campaign Fund, A09-26. At least, not as far as I know. Mr. Bonowitz, do you have a presentation? Or
if you like, I can make a brief presentation, or we can just answer
briefly
questions.
Because Commissioner Walther is trying to skip out of here at 2.
Okay.
I already texted and said I couldn't make it.
I told you
not
to.
Yeah, but we were going so long on this one issue, I figured no way are we going to make it.
He always does that. I always tell him, you're going to be out by a certain time, and he just...
No, you're good at it.
I'll still keep it brief.
Possible.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, we were all working toward that, man.
Thank you for that.
Jeez. All right, so now we can go on and on for... Does anybody else have any other plans? Okay.
I'll still keep it brief.
Today is Peterson's anniversary and Barrowman's anniversary, so they want to get out of here relatively at some point.
Congratulations, you two.
They're married on the same day.
Different years.
And they didn't know each other. Not to each other. They were married different years and different people. And they didn't know each other when they were married. Matt was married 17 years ago, and John was married 16 years ago. Did I get that right? Is it your anniversary, too?
I was going to say that a year ago, the earthquake happened, too.
Really? Oh, that was a terrible day. You guys have any comments about today?
Going swimmingly so far.
Today is my best friend from high school's birthday, too. Just FYI. Okay. Moving right along. Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Before you is the Audit Division Recommendation Memorandum on the National Campaign Fund, which recommends you approve two findings as presented in the draft final audit report. The two findings presented are misstatement of financial activity and failure to file notices and properly disclose independent expenditures. For the first finding, misstatement of financial activity, the committee amended its reports to materially correct the misstatements as recommended in the interim audit report. For the second finding, failure to file notices and properly disclose independent expenditures, NCF's response to the interim audit report and the draft final audit report provided information regarding its position that the purpose of its direct mail letters was fundraising and did not require reporting as independent expenditures. NCF has also indicated they plan to terminate after the audit was complete. We are prepared to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This audit really is a twin to the Legacy PAC audit. I believe
that's
represented
correct.
By the same counsel and
treasurer,
the issues
yes.
are almost precisely the same.
That's correct.
And last time, I think what we did, we have some, I think, disagreement as to which communications constitute express advocacy and which ones don't. I think that's the only issue. We circulated a list of which ones we thought were express advocacy yesterday. And the last time, I think the way we handled it was, I believe that at least half the commission is ready to approve the audit as is. And then if that deadlocks, then I could make a subsequent motion approving the audit and then indicating the list of communications that we think are express advocacy and then go from there. I don't know if anybody wants to speak, but I propose that as a means to putting us all out of our misery soon.
Madam Vice Chair.
It's fine. You know, we don't need another extended debate about express advocacy. I note that some of the Some of the communications that my colleagues are proposing to exclude contain phrases like, to help in the fight to put John McCain in the White House, I am rushing my generous contribution of blah. We have 30 days to establish a united front behind John McCain. This is the last push to make John McCain president. I'm urging you to stand solidly with the GOP and with John McCain until he emerges victorious. Yes, I will give a final donation to push John McCain and our GOP over the top. To help in this final push to Republican victory in election 2008, I am rushing my generous contribution of, I don't know, sure sounds like express advocacy to me. But, you know, it is what it is. Having said that, because I think there is express advocacy in all of the communications identified by the Audit Division, I move approval of agenda document number 12-59, the Audit Division Recommendation Memorandum on the National Campaign Fund.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion fails 3-3. Are there any other motions? Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that we approve the Audit Division recommendation memorandum on the on the National Campaign Fund audit A09-26, except that the following communications be considered to contain express advocacy, and those are 1 through 5, 7 through 13, 15 through 18, 21 through 25, 27 through 28, 34 through 47, 49, 52 through 53, and 61.
Thank you. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Stephen. All those opposed? The ayes have it 6-0. Thank you very much. Mr. Palmer, are there any management and administrative matters to discuss?
Madam Chair, there are no such matters.
Thank you. Hearing none, this meeting is adjourned, and I'd like to note it is 1:52, Steve.
You did good.